Welcome back to the program. If you were to think about a country that had made remarkable economic progress, a nation whose once closed economy has become one of the most open in the world, a country that has a growing middle class, a thriving multi-party competitive democracy, and a growing skilled workforce that is helping to restore manufacturing, most likely you would not think of Mexico. Because when we think of Mexico today, we often think of one of the most dangerous nations on the planet, a place where over 70,000 people have been killed in criminal violence and whose law enforcement and judicial system has broken down. The fact is that all of these things are true with respect to Mexico. Its complexity and its future are truly open questions for the 21st century. And few understand this better than our guest, Shannon O'Neill. Shannon O'Neill is a senior fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's an expert on Mexico. Her work has appeared in Foreign Affairs, American Quarterly, Foreign Policy, and the Washington Post. She's testified before Congress on U.S. policy toward Mexico and taught in the Political Science Department at Columbia University. She writes the blog Latin America's Moment, and she holds degrees from Yale and Harvard. It is my pleasure to welcome Shannon O'Neill to the program to talk about her new work, Two Nations Indivisible, Mexico and the United States and the Road Ahead. Shannon O'Neill, thanks so much for joining us.
So nice to be with you, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. When we look at Mexico today, we see a country that on so many levels has made remarkable progress in the past 20, 30 years. And sometimes I don't think that we give it all the credit it deserves for some of that progress.
I mean, this really is, to me, the untold story about our southern neighbor, is that Mexico has made these huge changes that you talked about in your introduction. You know, it's gone from a very closed economy to one that's incredibly open, one of the most open in the world, and one that today is dominated by manufactured goods and services. So it's a quite modern economy in many ways. This is a country that was known for years and years for its one-party rule for the PRI, which controlled Mexico for over 70 years. And today it's a competitive democracy. And it's also a country that we think about usually as a place of have and have not. So the Carlos Slims of the world, the wealthiest man in the world, as well as the tens and millions of poor. And those do all exist in Mexico. But what you've seen over the last couple of decades is a real growth in a middle class. And that is a fundamental change. So as we think about Mexico, we don't want to forget the real violence and the problems that are real and that we read in our headlines. But it's also incredibly important for the United States to understand these other changes that are happening, because at the same time, Mexico has become so much more important for the United States itself.
Given how important Mexico has become, given all of these areas of progress, why has it been so difficult in every way to tamp down that violence?
You know, Mexico, there's lots of reasons why we've seen an increase in violence. Some are quite long-term reasons. For instance, the changes in the drug trade, the movement from the center of the worldwide drug trade from Colombia to Mexico. Other changes actually had to do with democratization. When you had a one-party rule in many places in the country, there were tacit or sometimes even explicit agreements between some of the drug traffickers and the government. When you opened up with democratization, you have different political parties in there. All these old ways of doing things broke apart. And sometimes when you have uncertainty in illegal markets, it leads to much more bloodshed. A final reason is more short term. Under the last administration, President Calderon really went after the drug cartels. And so in confronting them directly, you saw a spike in violence. But overall, the real challenge for Mexico is, can it put into place a real democratic rule of law? And in part, the legacy of 70 years of one-party rule, of not as democracy, is that they didn't have those institutions. They didn't have a court system that worked in a democratic way. So they're just trying to create it right now, and it's a long process. We've seen other countries that have fought organized crime and struggled on the justice side. You know, our United States, we had our own moments with the mafia, and you think about movies like Serpico or L.A. Confidential or The Untouchables. You know, we had our own struggles, and that's really what Mexico is going through today.
One of the things that is sort of a corollary to this that has also been an ongoing problem, even within the context of economic growth and democracy, has been the level of corruption. Talk a little bit about that, Shannon.
I mean, this is a real problem in Mexico. Mexico is not unique in this. You look at countries around the world, emerging economies and others, and they do struggle with corruption. But Mexico's past history, the one-party rule, the way that government worked and the like, and the lack of a real functioning court system and law enforcement system has allowed corruption to really grow. And we're starting to see more and more of this. And you know, what's interesting actually is in the last year or so, we've seen through the press and other places, we've seen all these corruption cases come up, a lot of reporting on governors and business leaders and leaders of unions and the like in the corruption cases. So many are seeing more and more in Mexico. I mean, there's a real question whether there's more corruption today or it's just being exposed. If it's just being exposed, that actually may be a good thing. The fact that Mexico now has a free press that's out there and naming names and shaming some of these people. The fact that you're starting to see civil society organizations, nonprofits and the like, really go in and try to discover what's happening in government budgets and expose, you know, missing money and things. Those things are pretty new to Mexico. It makes corruption more visible, but perhaps it's also those first steps you need to take to temper corruption, to have a backlash against some of these old ways of doing things that are pretty non-democratic.
What has been the nexus, as you see it, between this corruption that has existed both at the government level and the business level and the limited access to capital that has been part and parcel of the Mexican economy? In that way, it's been very different than, say, Brazil or China or other developing economies.
You know, Mexico, for all the good things that's happened, the opening up of the economy, the transition to becoming a manufacturing hub and the like, there has a lot of things that hold it back, and I talk a bit about some of these issues in my book, but one of the big ones is this lack of financing. And, you know, we look in the United States and we think about, you know, just the array of financing, and sometimes we think about it as getting us into trouble, right? The 2008 financial crisis had to do with a lot of financing all over the economy. But Mexico's on the other extreme. There's very limited financing except for the top companies, many that can borrow on international markets. So if you're a small entrepreneur, you have a small company and you want to expand and build a new plant or expand your current one, hire more workers, it's very hard to get any sort of financing for your company, so you really can't grow. And that, you think about that and you aggregate it up beyond just one company or two companies and you think about the entire economy, it really holds the country back. If you don't have people who have good ideas or have a proven track record at a small level, you don't give them the ability to expand more broadly. And so that's a real challenge for this new government that's just come in the last 6 months, to how do you expand this part of the economy and really let the private sector, the engine, improve it and provide, you know, more opportunities for everybody.
And to what extent has that held the economy back? To what extent has that been a real drag on economic growth in Mexico?
It has. It's hard to quantify exactly the percentage and the like, but it definitely has been a drag, because when you look at economies around the world, it's small and medium-sized enterprises that create the majority of the jobs. And so if they can expand, then you're unlikely to create jobs as quickly. I mean, the other big challenge for Mexico's economy today is the concentration in so many parts of the economy, i.e. there's lots of monopolies or oligopolies, a couple companies that dominate particular sectors. And there, too, you squeeze out the little guy, but also somebody who might have some new ideas, have a real, you know, be wanting to take risks and bring in sort of new technologies or new ways of doing things when you have this concentration. And so Mexico, big challenge for this new government is how do you open up those sectors? And you know, to give this new government a little bit of credit, one of the first things they did, which passed just recently, was a telecommunications reform. Because in Mexico, you have one company that dominates both the landline market but the cell phone market. And so this reform, hopefully, should open it up to a bit more competition, bring in more investment and the like, but make it easier for Mexicans in general to, you know, make phone calls more cheaply. But that sort of extra cost from just one company dominating hits all of industry. It hits the entire economy because it just makes the price of doing business on a day-to-day basis more. So these are steps this government needs to take. It's gone a long way in the right direction, but there's more to do. And so these are the beginnings and something to be watching as we, you know, look to our neighbor and see how it's doing.
It's an interesting irony in the retail sector where the cost of goods has gone down. In many ways, that's because big international retailers have moved in. It's helped the middle class, but it's also created pressure in terms of small businesses.
I mean, that is a challenge, as we know, in our own country. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you bring in a Walmart or a Costco, and And the good thing there is they supply goods on at everyday low prices, and we benefit from that, being able to buy things for 20, 30, 40% cheaper than you would from, say, a little local store. But there is, as you mentioned, there's the cost. There's that local business. What happens to that person, and where can they go if they can't compete with these large, you know, international supply chains that allow the lower prices? So in all of this, you think about the, you know, growth of economies, the modernization of economies, you know, there's winners and losers. And what you hope over the long term is that there's more winners than losers. And for Mexico, I can say that who has benefited are consumers. And there's been some studies that have come out that show that actually since NAFTA in the last 20 years, the price of that basic basket of goods has come down by almost half. And so you think about people living on a pretty limited wage base, that makes a huge difference in your day-to-day life.
You mentioned manufacturing before. One of the things that you discussed, the kind of manufacturing that we're seeing in Mexico today is not lowest cost, least common denominator manufacturing, but some highly skilled and technical manufacturing as well.
That has been a big change. You look back in the 1990s when NAFTA had just come into effect, and a lot of what was happening on the Mexican side of the border was just assembly, just basic, pretty simple manufacturing, and then things would come back to the United States. In the early 2000s, a lot of those factories left Mexico for China, where the cost, the labor costs are much lower, especially back then. So today what you've seen with the revival of a manufacturing industry is a real change. And so today it's flat screen TVs and auto parts and aerospace and white goods and all sorts, computers, all sorts of things like that. And it's a different market, and it's a more, many of these companies require more technical training, advanced degrees and the like. So Mexico is trying to move up this value added change. And in this process, the other thing that's quite important has changed is the link to the United States. So when things are made, quote unquote, in Mexico, often what really is happening is they're being made both in the United States and in Mexico. And a telling statistic on this is for everything that comes in from Mexico, so quote unquote, made in Mexico, almost 40% of that product on average was actually made in the United States by U.S. workers. So that really attests to this deepness, this really profound ties in just the very making of things between our two countries, which is very different from the past, but also different from almost any other country in the world, these ties we have with Mexico.
That's both because of the border, but also because of the positive impact of NAFTA.
It is. I mean, NAFTA is really the reason that we have this back and forth. And so Mexico, it's 40% in terms of production that's made in the United States, things that come from Mexico. Canada, our other NAFTA partner, it's 25%, so lower than Mexico. But it's these two countries that really stand out in terms of these ties. When you look at China or Europe or, say, Brazil, it's 4%. So it's almost nothing that's made in the United States that comes from those nations. But both our NAFTA partners, it's a big percentage of what happens. And that really shows how linked we are just in the very making of products. And when we think about the United States, how do we get back on our feet? How are we competitive internationally vis-a-vis China or other countries around the world? You know, our NAFTA partners are going to be part of that process, helping us remain competitive and in that process, maintaining and creating jobs here.
Are we going to see a greater effort towards privatization in a number of these monopoly sectors in Mexico, things like energy and, you mentioned before, telecommunications?
Well, we have different phenomena going on there. Some of the areas that have these monopolies are already private, like telecommunications. So the challenge for the government is to get in there and use regulation to make it more competitive, and even in the end, if they need to break it up, to allow competition to come in. But there is one big sector that's still part of the government, part of the state, and that is energy. The state-owned Pemex, which controls energy, everything from exploring and producing to the pipelines to the retail gas stations, that's all owned by the state. And so this government has said that one of the big reforms they want to push through this year in the fall is to open that up, to open it up to some private investment, to allow companies from around the world to come in and share their expertise, particularly in new types of energy, things like shale oil and gas that Mexico has a big percentage of, things like deep water drilling in the Gulf where Mexico has a big part alongside the United States, how to let companies come in, because Pemex has shown it can't do it by itself. It doesn't have the skills. It doesn't have a lot of the financing. And it, we also, it wants to share the risk, because these are the types of energy where there's a huge upside, but there's also a huge downside. So how do you make sure that the Mexican taxpayer doesn't shoulder all of that risk?
And as you point out, a big part of the problem is that Pemex accounts for a significant percentage of funding the Mexican government.
It does. I mean, what's happened with this state-owned enterprise is the money that comes in from the oil that Pemex produces, a lot of that goes into the government, paid as royalties to the government, and funds a third, perhaps even a bit more, of the overall federal budget. So as Mexico looks forward, looks to opening perhaps its energy sector, so production can increase, which has been quite stagnant over the last few years, it's going to have to rethink how it funds its government. Do you raise taxes? Do you work better to collect taxes? One of Mexico's challenges is there's a huge part of the economy that is informal, i.e. it's not registered, it doesn't pay taxes, it's not really part of the system. So how do you bring that 40-plus percent of the economy into the formal sector, begin to collect taxes on it, begin to make it, you know, part of the overall fabric within Mexico? That would go a long way to replacing, if needed, the revenue that comes in from Pemex today.
One of the things that you discuss is the birth rate in Mexico, which has been steadily declining. Talk about that.
When we look at Mexico's society and the changes, there's been this rise of the middle class, and there's lots of reasons for that. There's urbanization. Most Mexicans today live in cities rather than the countryside. There's women going into the workforce. Women in the workforce has doubled over the last couple of decades. But a big change, too, has been the size of Mexican families. So in the 1970s, the average Mexican family would have 7 kids. Today, the average family has 2 kids, the same rate here as in the United States. And you see that change. It has a lot to do with people staying in school longer, particularly women staying in school longer, women coming into the workforce, just changing social mores and cultural shifts. But what it does mean is going forward, you have a very different family structure, a very different way of thinking about the world. Families, especially as they start earning more, have more money to invest in their kids. And you've seen that kids particularly investing in their education. So kids staying longer in school. Kids today stay twice as much time in school as they did, say, 25 years ago. And more Mexicans are finishing high school and going on to college and in other advanced degrees. And so that is a shift that has happened in part because of society there, but also in part because of fewer kids. You have more time and more to invest in just your 2 kids on average rather than many more.
What's been the broader ramification of this urbanization, of this migration from the rural areas to the cities? We've seen it as a mixed bag, for example, in China. How has it played out in Mexico?
Well, China and Mexico have differences given their history and their sheer size and the like. In Mexico, there's no legal differentiation between those that live in rural areas and those who live in urban areas. So that sort of, the ties to you in China don't exist. But it has been an important phenomenon moving from a rural society, one based very much on agriculture and commodities like oil, to today a much more urban society and one where the economy is really driven by manufacturing and services. So that shift, you know, most people, economists and others say is a good shift when you think about wanting your nation to climb the ranks to a middle-class nation or a country that earns $10,000 per capita, $20,000 per capita, perhaps $30,000 per capita, putting you in to the ranks of Europe or getting towards the United States. So that shift is good. But, you know, Mexico's also had its growing pains in the very fast urbanization. So places like Mexico City, which have some 20 million people living there, it takes a while for governments to catch up and build, you know, the sewage systems, the electricity system, the water systems and the like to keep up with this massive migration. And so we've seen that there. We've seen it along the border, places like Ciudad Juarez or Tijuana and the like. And some people argue that the slowness of the government to catch up with this movement, so catching up and building schools and building places for young people, has been part of the violence that we've seen, that you have a group of young people who didn't have a chance to go to school or were left out on the margins of this modernizing economy. And often when they see little opportunity for the long run, they turn to short-run opportunities in the illegal economy.
How does Mexico see itself in comparison to other developing nations, places like Brazil and India and China?
You know, Mexico doesn't get talked about as much as some of these other nations, and particularly the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, have gotten a lot of play on the international sphere and in international meetings and the like as the wave of the future and where the world economy is going. Mexico hasn't been included in these groupings, but Mexico has a lot to offer here, and it is one of the, you know, the top 10, 15 world economies. It's made this transition that many of these other countries, Brazil and the like, have yet to do to a real manufacturing-based, a services-based, a more, you know, intellectually-based type of work versus commodities that are much more volatile within the world. So there's many things going for Mexico, and the question for Mexico is today it's at a crossroads. So will it continue to do well? Will it become a top 10 economy, a thriving democracy, one guided by a growing middle class? Or will it succumb to the violence, to the corruption, to the weakening of the social fabric of communities? And that's really the crossroads, the fork that it's at today. And I think the important thing is, one, for Mexicans to push to go down the right path, but for us here in the United States to help where we can, because what happens in Mexico, whether it's good or bad, has repercussions far beyond just the U.S.-Mexico border.
What should the United States be doing with respect to getting Mexico through this period and over this hurdle that you talk about?
Well, we can help them in many ways. Some are on the security side. Given much of the violence or the money that's behind these organized crime groups comes from drug trafficking into the United States, so our demand. We can help them in this long and quite laborious process of trying to create a real rule of law, trying to reform their court systems, trying to professionalize their police forces and the like. There's a role we can play in helping with resources, but also with expertise, with exchanges of police officers, of lawyers, of judges, as they try to build up a real system. But as much and probably as important or more important is on the economic side. Given the links that we have in terms of companies, in terms of production, we can help them by facilitating the crossing of trade and the things across the U.S.-Mexico border. And in helping them, we're actually helping ourselves, because the investment will benefit U.S. companies, will benefit U.S. workers, U.S. communities, because more trade has been shown in many studies to have benefits, net benefits on both sides. So it really is a win-win proposition in so many ways.
How has the immigration debate and all the rhetoric that surrounds it in this country, how has that impacted specifically on policy?
You know, the rhetoric that we've seen over the last several years and continues in the current debates in the Congress, it isn't helpful in the U.S.-Mexico relationship. It makes it difficult, not just on that particular issue, which has changed dramatically. You know, the Mexicans coming into the United States over the last 3 years have reached a net zero. So a similar number coming in is going out. So this wave that we saw of Mexicans coming in the 90s and early 2000s has really dissipated. But it has made it difficult, some of the heightened rhetoric, to get things done on other areas, whether it's working together on the border, whether it's working together on trade and economic issues, whether it's working together on security and the environment and water and all these sorts of shared interests and sometimes tensions between the two nations. So one result, if the U.S. Congress can come to some sort of accord that they can agree on, that then President Obama will sign, if we could find a resolution to some of the immigration side, it would make it easier to work together on so many other issues in the bilateral relationship.
Shannon O'Neill, her book is Two Nations Indivisible, Mexico and the United States and the Road Ahead. Shannon, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Jeff, it was a real pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.